Northwestern University presents The Reviewing Stand, a program in its 12th year on the Mutual Network, a platform which the university shares with guests from business, industry, labor, government, and the press. Today we discuss, what have the Republicans done with their congressional majority? You can participate in these weekly discussions in two ways. Listen to the facts and opinions of the speakers. Read the printed word-for-word transcript of the discussion. $1 will bring you these pamphlets for the next 26 weeks, $2 for 1 year, 10 cents for a single copy. Write to The Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago, Illinois. The first speaker on today's broadcast, speaking from Washington, is the Honorable Carl E. Mundt, Congressman from South Dakota. Congressman Mundt.
Good morning, fellow citizens. It is a pleasure for me to speak on the forum of the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand to give my answer to the question, what have the Republicans done with their congressional majority? That is a specific question, and as a Republican, I feel it merits a specific, detailed answer. While it is natural that the minority party of Congress, the Democrat Party, should endeavor to minimize the achievements of the Republican majority, I find that even the Democrats are hard put to it to get down to specific items when it comes to criticizing the record made by the Republicans in the slightly more than 3 months that we have been in control of Congress. The critics of the Republican record are long on glib generalities, but they are short, very short indeed, on specific criticisms. To honestly and fairly evaluate the record of the Republican majority in this new 80th Congress, it is obviously essential that we bear in mind that we Republicans took over after the New Deal had controlled both Congress and the White House for 14 long, expensive years. No realistic American would expect that in 14 weeks, the Republican Party could correct all of the excesses and abuses which grew up in the more than 720 weeks during which the New Deal Democrats held absolute power in Washington. However, the record of our achievements, even in this short period of time, tells an eloquent story of its own. Let me give it to you from the undeniable record of results obtained. Most of the first month of the new Congress was spent in putting into effect the new Congressional Reorganization Act. The number of committees was drastically reduced. New committee staffs were appointed, and the expert counselors provided for in the Reorganization Act were acquired and assigned. New procedures were adopted. For the first time in nearly a century and a half, the whole machinery of Congress was drastically overhauled and revitalized. We Republicans had charge of that reorganization. It took time, but in less than a month, the job was completed, and the new congressional machinery was set in motion. The Republican Party had kept faith with the people, and the reorganization of Congress became a fact instead of a theory. Now let us examine the 8 specific promises made by the Republican Party in the last campaign and test those 8 pledges by our record of performance down to date. 1, we Republicans promised that if we obtained control of Congress, we would drive the communists from the federal payroll. Republican Speaker Joe Martin made that promise the theme of his address, accepting the speakership on the opening day of Congress. The Republican-controlled House Committee on Un-American Activities brought out legislation creating a loyalty commission to purge the payroll of all communists. The Republican-controlled Appropriations Committee denied appropriations to some bureaus which were packed with communists and pinks. The movement gained such momentum that on March 22nd, President Truman threw in the sponge, recognized the handwriting on the wall, and issued an executive proclamation to purge from the payroll the very same communists and other subversives that had wormed their way into government under the New Deal administration. Republican action in Congress made swift work of fulfilling our first campaign pledge to the people. 2. We Republicans promised that if given a majority in Congress, we would give substance and solidarity to our American concept that ours is a government by law and not by men, through passing a constitutional amendment barring any future president from perpetuating himself in office beyond two terms. That pledge has been kept. Both houses have approved the amendment, and it has already been ratified by several Republican legislatures. Number three, during the campaign, we pledged that a Republican Congress would reduce government waste and extravagance. Every appropriation bill thus far considered has reduced the president's budget substantially. Hundreds of millions of dollars have already been saved the taxpayer, and the biggest appropriation bills are yet to be considered. The total savings will run into the billions. Four, we promised that government by edict would end in America if a Republican Congress were elected. That promise has been kept. The stream of directives, executive orders, and edicts which flowed out of Washington prior to last November 5th has dwindled to a tiny trickle. Thousands of bureaucrats have lost their lost jobs. More are to go as additional appropriation bills come up on the legislative schedule. Representative government by citizens elected to Congress has been restored in America. Number five, we Republicans promised new labor legislation to spur production and stop shortages. Both houses of Congress have already passed legislation to end the portal-to-portal pay fiasco, which grew directly out of New Deal malpractices in labor. For many weeks, the labor committees of Senate and House have been holding hearings and perfecting legislation on the general problem of labor-management relationships. Next week, that legislation will be brought to the floor for action. Congress will pass it. But coming events have already cast their shadows before them. Production has increased. Shortages are disappearing. An economy of plenty is replacing the New Deal economy of controlled scarcities. Number six, Republicans promised that our aid to foreign sufferers overseas would be used to provide relief for human suffering rather than political fuel for rival ideologies. That promise has been kept. UNRWA is dead. The program recommended by former Republican President Hoover is being adopted. No longer will American taxpayers provide fuel for the torches of totalitarianism abroad. Number seven, we Republicans promised tax relief to an American public which for the 14 years of New Deal control of Congress had had its taxes increased 17 times. The House has already acted on legislation reducing personal income taxes by as much as 30%. The Senate Finance Committee is now considering the legislation. The Republican Congress is keeping faith with the people on the matter of reducing taxes. Number eight. Finally, we Republicans promised that a Republican Congress would work with the administration in perfecting and promoting a bipartisan all-American foreign policy. That policy has been abundantly and dramatically fulfilled in connection with that pledge. The Republican majority has given its approval to the president's proposal for aid to Turkey and Greece. We are supporting Secretary Marshall's efforts in Moscow. We have kept our promise that politics would stop at the water's edge. But more than that, we have made the development of a bipartisan American foreign policy a two-way street in which Republican leadership is contributing quite as much as the administration to the formation of our foreign policy. In addition, we have kept our pledge to force out the facts so that the American public also can help fashion and formulate our foreign policy. Even the secret agreements of Yalta, Tehran, and Potsdam have at long last been made public under Republican pressure. Fellow Americans, we Republicans were elected on the eight foregoing promises. Each of them has been kept. Your Republican majority in Congress is only 14 weeks old, but it has already demonstrated its fidelity to the platform on which it was elected. By the time Congress adjourns in midsummer, even greater dividends are certain to accrue to the American public as a consequence of its wise and prudent decision made so overwhelmingly at the polls last November 5th.
Thank you, Congressman Mundt. To continue today's discussion, the reviewing stand now takes you to Mutual Studios in Chicago. James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech at Northwestern University, is the moderator. Dean McBurney.
May we thank you, too, Congressman Mundt. Joining Mr. Mundt on the reviewing stand are Tracy Strieve, professor of history, and Marshall Dimmock, professor of political science, both of Northwestern University. Mr. Mundt has discussed the Republican record in relation to the campaign pledges of the party. Does he summarize these pledges fairly as you see it, Dimmock?
Well, first of all, I think we should say that Congressman Mundt has delivered a very able speech. Now, as to whether or not he has summarized the situation accurately depends upon whether you judge what he said in the election, or what he probably said, or what the Republican Party said. Now, if you mean the Republican Party, then you have to determine what you mean by the Republican Party. And on that, the answer seems to be that the Republican Party didn't have as clear-cut a program as Congressman Mundt has said in his statement. It was said, for example, in the editorial comment of one of the Republican newspapers in Chicago the day after the election, that it was indecisive with regard to what the election meant because the Republican Party had no one recognized leader and no recognized program. When Congressman Mundt says, for example, that there were 8 specific pledges that were made to the voters, that's undoubtedly true so far as he is concerned. But nationwide, the Republican Party had no such clear-cut program.
Do you have an opinion on that, Strieve?
I would agree with Dimmock. It is obvious that last fall there was not a party platform as such, and I think the general interpretation given to the vote was that it was a protest vote. I do think, however, that Congressman Mundt has raised several important issues. I think it is clear that we must objectively discuss these issues in terms of the point of view which has been expressed.
Well, now I suggest we examine the Republican record on the items which the Congressman has discussed for us. Obviously, we cannot consider all of these. What is most important here, Dimmock?
Well, Congressman Mundt said that there were 8 points that he was going to develop, and it's perfectly obvious that if we attempted to deal with each one of these at any length, that we wouldn't have time for it, and also it would be very confusing. And therefore, we need to pick out what seem to be the most important combinations of questions. I would say there are 3. First, the economic situation of the country. That is, whether or not we are going to continue to have prosperity or whether we're going into a depression. And secondly, the whole field of labor legislation. And thirdly, the whole field of foreign relations. I think those are the most important areas.
Would you consider the communist purge an important Republican achievement, Strieve?
Actually, not too important. I would like to point out that historically, there has been an Un-American Activities Committee organized in Congress, which has operated over a long period of time. The old Dies Committee was a committee which was moving in this direction.
How about Mundt's point that the Republicans have reduced bureaucracy in government by edict, Dimmock?
Well, there again, I think that it's necessary to be objective that one take an historical approach to this question. And within the last few years, there has been a considerable machinery developed to get away from government by edict. I refer to such things, for example, as the Federal Register and to the various studies that have been made by the Attorney General's Committee in order to do away with arbitrary action, the giving of publicity to all kinds of edicts that have been put out, edicts in the words of Congressman Mundt. I think one thing that needs to be said with regard to this question is that there have not been as many administrative orders issued recently because, unfortunately, the federal government has been very largely ineffectual in recent years because of the fact that price controls were done away with so precipitately and because so many other actions were taken that were not very carefully considered. And because of the fact that Congress and the President, being of different political parties, have not worked together as they would have if they belonged to the same political party. And I would say that that is probably the principal explanation of why the number of administrative orders has been fewer.
Well, now, before we get on to what you seem to think are the 3 important questions here, do you have an opinion on the constitutional amendment limiting the President to 2 terms in office? Strebe, do you regard this as a Republican achievement?
Actually, point of view in regard to this question is shared by members of both parties. I think it has to be interpreted in view of only one example, namely the four terms to which Mr. Roosevelt was elected. There have been no other such examples in the history of the presidency. I think the point of view depends to some degree upon personal preference. Certainly, as one looks back over the record of the presidency, there have been many strong presidents who have aspired to even more than two terms, even though only in one case did that become a reality.
Well, now let's get on to the, if you wish, to the three questions that Dimmock has indicated as being most important for our consideration: the economic situation, the labor question, and foreign relations. What does the Republican leadership presage for business stability, Dimmock?
Well, that's a pretty large question, and I think in some ways it's the most important question. At the present time, the economic situation is satisfactory, but as the economic advisors of the president have pointed out, it's threatening. Now, suppose we look into that a moment. Congress made provision for a board of economic advisors to the president, and three of them, very able economists, have been appointed. They brought out their report about the first of the year, and it was sent to Congress. Congress also provided that when this report came out, it should be turned over to a joint committee in order to take any action that was necessary to prevent the development of a depression. Now, what did this report say? It said that we had the highest level of national income and of employment that we've ever had in history, that they thought that probably we could get through the year 1947 without a recession, but that there were dangerous signals in the offing. Now, what are these danger signals? The first one is that we have dropped in the percentage of our national savings very precipitately. In 1945, it was 23.8%. In the following year, 1946, it dropped to 12.1%. In other words, it was cut almost in half. It had been up over 28% during the war. Now, why this big drop in savings? Well, the answer is that prices have got out of control, and a large number of people, most poor people, middle-class people, have used up their savings. Another factor is that the inventories of perishable goods, non-durable goods, have been increasing so rapidly that in many lines there's already an overproduction. Now, putting two and two together, when you have high prices which reduce people's net income, that is their real income, when the balance of savings diminishes rapidly, and when the goods on hand increase rapidly, you get an imbalance. And the imbalance results in a dangerous situation. Now, there are two ways out of it. One of them is to get out of it gradually by a gradual reduction of prices. And the other one is to have prices continue to go up and up with the result that the bottom falls out of things. It seems to me that the fundamental question is which of these two is going to happen. Now, it looks as though if we don't do something soon to bring about a gradual reduction of prices, that we're going to be in a depression. And if we are in a depression, that is, of course, the most serious charge that can be brought against any party in power.
Do you have an opinion on that, Strebe?
Well, isn't it obvious that another critical problem is the financing of the national debt? That is, Congress is faced, the nation is faced, with a debt structure of some $256 billion. As I understand economics, it has often been argued that tax reductions should only be made during periods when such reductions benefit the public. When the nation is prosperous, taxes should be maintained at a relatively high figure, and the national debt to that degree could be financed. I'm not altogether sure that tax reductions at this time, at least in terms of that argument, presages a very healthy situation.
As a matter of fact, most of the economists of the country have gone on record at one time or another in support of just the position that you've outlined, and it's obvious that it is the only valid position. When a country has a large national income, it can afford to pay higher taxes than when it's poor. And therefore, in a time in which we have the largest national income, it seems inconsistent to cut expenditures, especially when there is now the prospect of a considerable expansion of governmental expenditures because of the so-called Truman Doctrine. The best estimates that I've been able to get in recent days seem to indicate that probably that expenditure will amount to $1 billion or more, $1 billion or more, in the next year. And it's impossible to say how much it will cost. We know that the initial cost will be about $400 million. So that the problem arises, how can you reduce governmental income with one hand and with the other hand pass out money in large amounts? Of course, the answer is that you can't do it.
And, of course, another answer is that thus far, these bills that have been enacted by one House has to be supported by the other, and the general history of such procedure has been to bring about a compromise or some revision. It's not completely clear to that degree as to what will be the final nature of any so-called reduction.
Well, now Mr. Munt pointed out that the Republicans promised to cut the federal budget drastically, that they're in the process of doing that, that they promised to give us tax relief, that they're in the process of doing that. In the light of your analysis, I come back to my original question. What does the Republican leadership presage for business stability? What is your final answer on that?
The final answer on that is that Congress, in connection with this program of having a Board of Economic Advisors, is supposed to act upon this joint report of the Economic Advisors. Congress was slow in getting around to creating this joint committee to deal with the economic report. What it does in the way of preventive legislation remains to be seen. What it is able to do to support the president in bringing about a reduction of inflationary prices remains to be seen. I think probably the best answer to your question is a statement that came out of Washington yesterday in a dispatch from Paul R. Leach, in which he said the new GOP Congress is at the halfway mark, assuming it is going to get its work done and go home about July 1st. Its big questions and the mainline election promises of last fall are still hanging fire. Now that applies to the economic situation. You just can't say at the present moment what's going to happen, but you can say that something will have to be done soon or we're likely to be in a depression.
Would Leach's answer apply as well to our second question, the labor question? How about the Republican record on this matter? Are we getting constructive leadership, Strebe, from the Republicans on the labor question?
It appears obvious that there has been a considerable amount of division. However, day before yesterday, a bill has been passed by the House committee and which will shortly be introduced onto the House floor. It does provide for various labor restrictions. It provides for a 75-day cooling-off period before strikes can take place in vital industries. It provides for the elimination of the closed shop in favor of a union shop, and so on and so forth. However, such a bill will have to be submitted to the Senate, and it is obvious that the Senate is divided, probably a little bit more pro-labor, if we can call it that, in their point of view, than is true of the House. Again, we'll have to wait and see what a compromise can be worked out.
Have the Republicans used their congressional majority to good purpose in determining foreign policy? To move on to our third question.
I think that the statement that Congressman Munt made on that question is certainly true, that up till now, we have had a bipartisan foreign policy. And this has been particularly true because Senator Vandenberg has played such an important part in all of the negotiations and in all of the work of the United Nations. On the other hand, being realists, we need to recognize that within the Republican Party, some very sharp
splits are beginning to appear or have appeared already in connection with foreign policy, as illustrated, for example, by the breach which has existed between Vandenberg and Taft over several things, and particularly the Lilienthal appointment. And hence, one of the things that needs to be taken into account in trying to answer our question, what have the Republicans done with their congressional majority, is that in foreign relations, as well as on the question of labor legislation, and also on what to do about taxes, there have appeared already serious splits within the Republican leadership. And the result is that it is very difficult to predict what is going to happen, because if these splits widen, then you're likely to have ineffectuality.
Another aspect of this problem of foreign policy that I think is important is the way in which the President of the United States, in handling this particular issue, was able to create what we might call a de facto situation in which, without consultation, without public opinion being taken in consideration, a clean-cut announcement was made of, in a sense, a new foreign policy. It's obvious that...
You refer there to the situation in Greece and Turkey.
Yes, and the probability in Korea and elsewhere around the world. In other words, the president can put Congress, he can put the nation in a very difficult situation by such an announcement. Either Congress or the nation will have to support the president, or to that degree we may lose a considerable amount of influence or lose face in terms of what our policy has been.
I think that Strieve is absolutely right about that. There are many things about the so-called Truman Doctrine that I think are criticizable, but the one that I dislike most of all is the way the whole program was launched. There was not an opportunity to get the facts. There was not an opportunity to discuss it. Congress did not have an opportunity to discuss it before it was announced to the world, with the result that one of the things that Congressman Muntz said, I think, needs to be revised in terms of this recent development. He said that Congress had grown in influence. I think, generally speaking, that's true. Congress has been in the saddle. I'm very glad to see that. Congress should be the center of political gravity. But this recent statement with regard to the so-called Truman Doctrine has given Congress quite a setback because of the fact that it was launched in such a way that Congress has to support it.
Well, now, in very brief conclusion, gentlemen, what have the Republicans done with their congressional majority? Strieve?
Well, thus far, they have not passed any important legislation. Several bills are pending or have recently come from committee. The outcome will depend on probable compromises and also, I think, with an eye to 1948.
Dimmock?
Another factor is that these splits within the Republican leadership, which I mentioned earlier, may indicate that the majority in the Republican Party may not be able to accomplish as much as we first thought.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, What Have the Republicans Done with Their Congressional Majority? We invite you to subscribe now for copies of the Reviewing Stand weekly discussions. $1 for the next 6 months, $2 for an entire year. A printed copy of today's discussion may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago, Illinois. Participating as guests today were the Honorable Carl E. Munt, Congressman from South Dakota, Tracy Strieve, Professor of History, and Marshall E. Dimmock, Professor of Political Science, both of Northwestern University. Our moderator, James H. McBurney, will now tell you about next week's program.
Next week, today, how high are prices going to go? Guest speakers will be Walter E. Hoadley, industrial economist with the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago, James R. Hawkinson, professor of marketing, and Clark Lee Allen, assistant professor of economics, both of Northwestern University. We invite you to listen.
The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast every week as a public service feature of Mutual. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.